I remember when I was about 14 or 15 years old, and I had been brought into the hobby of photography. And I had my single lens reflex Canon camera, and I had moved from just taking pictures into developing my own film and printing my own photographs. And I wanted more and more pieces for my darkroom, and I wanted the pans, and I wanted the right chemicals, and of course, I wanted a Durst F30. Anybody remember what a Durst F30 was? Nobody can think that far back. I mean, I'm that old. Now, what is that thing that stands on a stand and looks down and shines the light onto the paper, which imprints the paper with the photograph? What do you call those things? Ah, the Durst F30 was an enlarger, and it was a small one. It was the great. It was the best one to start with, and I wanted a Durst F30 in the worst possible way. But, of course, I couldn't afford one, being 14 or 15 years old, so I had asked for one for Christmas. And my dad had taken a business trip to Tokyo, and I was just thinking that maybe on that trip to Tokyo, he would be able to purchase that Durst F30 for me so it would be under the tree Christmas morning. Well, when Mom and I went up to pick Dad at the airport up in Bangkok, Thailand, there was Dad coming, and I expected to see him maybe at the luggage carrier part, this big old box come down, because you know I had always assumed that Durst F30 stood about that high, and the base was probably about that wide, so I was expecting a box about that high and that wide. And so when we went down to pick up the luggage, all that came down the luggage ramp that Dad picked up was his old a Halliburton suitcase. Y'all remember the Halliburton metal suitcases? Been in the oil business, that's, of course, what you had, and they went around the world and never leaked. You couldn't cut into one, and they could sit on a tarmac in an airport in a third world country in which the rain was pouring down and none of your clothes would get wet or harmed in any way. And all that Dad picked up from the luggage rack was this one suitcase. So he had his one suitcase and his briefcase. He had something a little under his arm as we walked out to the car. And so I just lost all my hopes of getting a Durst F30 for Christmas, because that was the last chance that we had. Christmas was just around the corner, maybe just a few days away, and Dad wasn't making any more business trips. And so my heart just sunk as low could be. But I remember a Christmas morning, my sister Debbie would run into my bedroom every Christmas morning before we went out to see the tree, and she had taken a glimpse of the tree, and she came into my room, and she said, boy, there's a lot of presents under the tree, Jeff. And I said, great, is there one about this high and about this wide? And she shook her head and said, no, I took a really good look, and there wasn't anything that big under the tree, and my hopes were just dashed again. And then we all went out to the tree, and as we did at our house on Christmas morning, Mom had baked fresh donuts, and we were eating fresh baked donuts, and Mom had baked fresh biscuits, and there were biscuits and butter and jam being passed around, and we were opening presents as we did in our household, which always began with the younger, and the youngest one opened a gift, and of course that was always me. I was the baby of the family, 6'7" baby, and we went up the line from youngest to elder. We always did a round like that, and then got a new present each of us. And boy, I opened 5, 6, maybe 7 presents, and none of them were anywhere near a Durst F30. And my heart just kept falling with every present. Every present was just another disappointment. And then at the end, as Mama frequently did, the big presents were always left for the last. And I remember Marty, my middle sister, got hers, and Debbie, my eldest sister, got hers, and Mom gave one to Dad. And then they brought over a box to me that was about that wide and about that deep, but only about that high. And I'm thinking, I don't know what this is. I don't some new pair of underwear or a sweater, you know, just the kind of thing kids like to get on Christmas, clothes, you know, particularly boys' clothes. And I opened that thing, and lo and behold, if it wasn't a Durst F-30. Because you see, Durst F-30s, I didn't recognize, they broke down, right? They broke down into a package that was only that high and that long and about that wide, and lo and behold, there was the Durst F-30 that I had wanted more than anything else. I must have been the most surprised boy in Bangkok, Thailand that morning. And I remember Dad and I went and set it up after Christmas morning, and I was making photographs all day long Christmas. That was a huge surprise in my life. That was something I wasn't expecting to happen on Christmas morning. Can you all remember some huge surprises in your lives? Share with me some of the biggest surprises where you weren't expecting something and bam, out of the blue, something happened. Surprise somebody. Go. Durst F-30? No. No. Wow, boy, that eclipses a Durst F-30. Yeah. Another surprise, somebody. Something just out of the blue happens that you was the last thing you were expecting. Yep. Oh, gosh. Isn't that something? Surprises. What we've just been talking about here are surprises that we were happy to receive. Those are really the surprises that we like to talk about the most, aren't they? It's easier for us to talk about them. It's happier. It raises spirits. It gets us going in the morning. There are some surprises that happen at the end of the book of Genesis, however, which are surprises which are welcomed by some, but not welcomed by others. But boy, does God show some surprises. Remember, we've gone through almost the entire story of Joseph. And we pretty well knew where the story of Joseph was going because God had given Joseph dreams where he would be raised up and people would be bowing down before him, including his dad and his brothers. And we pretty well had a good idea of where the story of Joseph was going, and that's exactly where it went. God puts Joseph in charge of all of Egypt, second only to the Pharaoh. And Joseph is able to save up grain and food for the 7 years of famine. He's able to bring his family all the way from the land of Canaan, where there is no food, into the land of Egypt, where there's food aplenty. He's able to gather more land for Pharaoh. He's able to increase the wealth of Pharaoh. He's able to increase the geographical real estate holdings of Pharaoh. He is able just to do everything that Pharaoh could possibly imagine that his second in command would do. And so he's been able to save the family of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's been able to save the Egyptian people. And Joseph is poised to be the most important person in the entire land, particularly the most important person of the family of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so all of our expectations now are that the promises that God made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are somehow now going to be fulfilled through this one that he has been raising up, and that Joseph is now going to be the main character through which God is going to work. That Joseph is going to be the one that that God is going to bring the line of the Messiah through. That Joseph and Joseph's tribe is going to be the one which will be the most highly exalted among the people of Israel. We are positioned now for God to continue to do the biggest and the brightest and the most wonderful things through Joseph. But then we get to chapter 48. And we expect that that in chapter 48, what's going to happen is that Joseph and everything that Joseph wants, everything that Joseph expects, is going to be what is going to happen, because God has raised Joseph up and raised Joseph up and raised Joseph up to where our expectations now are that Joseph is just going to fly into outer space with greatness and with the fulfillment of everything he could possibly imagine. And so Joseph in chapter 48 brings his two boys to his dad for blessing. He's on his deathbed. Dad is just hours away from death. But nonetheless, Joseph brings his sons in order to be blessed by Jacob. And notice that in verse 15, the blessing takes place to Joseph. May the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has delivered me from all harm, may he bless these boys. May they be called by my name and the names of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and may they increase greatly upon the earth. Now verse 17. When Joseph saw his father placing his right hand on Ephraim's head, one of Joseph's boys, he was displeased. So he took hold of his father's hand to move it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. Joseph said to him, "No, my father, this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head." But his father refused and said, "I know, my son. I know. He too will become a people. And he too will become great. Nevertheless, his younger brother will be greater than he, and his descendants will become a group of nations." He blessed them that day and said, "In your name will Israel pronounce this blessing. May God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh." So he put Ephraim ahead of Manasseh. Oh, man, can you imagine Joseph's horror? You see, the firstborn is to receive the blessing of the firstborn. And Joseph brings both of his kids in expecting that his dad will bless the firstborn with the blessings of the firstborn, giving to the firstborn the greatest blessing. After all, Joseph has just gone to all the trouble to bring his dad and all of his brothers into Egypt, to set up his dad and all of his brothers with the highest blessings and the best fruit of the land of Egypt. As a matter of fact, he has orchestrated everything that he has done for the last several chapters in order to bring dad and all of his brothers into the land of Egypt so they can be blessed. And this is the way that his dad repays him. The way that his dad repays him is by switching the blessing, giving to the secondborn the best blessing and giving to the firstborn the least blessing. Man, talk about surprises. Of course, you understand that Joseph was receiving these blessings upon his children, and his dad was giving these blessings based upon the will of God. It was God who had revealed to Joseph's father that the best blessing was to go to the younger, and the second best blessing was to go to the elder. This was God's will. It's God who made the switch in the same way, and he has made other switches in the book of Genesis. Other secondborns had been blessed as the firstborn should be blessed. And once again, the Lord is fulfilling his promise in the way in which the Lord wishes to fulfill his promise, and he is switching what the culture would expect. As a matter of fact, what the culture would demand. He is bringing about his will in contradiction to what the family expected, to what the culture expected, what was demanded by the culture and the family. And he makes no apology for it. He just simply says, this is all he says. I know, my son. I know. He too will become a people, and he too will become great. Nevertheless, his younger brother will be greater than he, and his descendants will become a group of nations. He blessed them that day and said, in your name will Israel pronounce this blessing. May God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. So what would you do? How would you feel if everything was supposed to go this way? If the culture in which God had worked for years was supposed to bring this outcome to where you had all of these hopes, all of these expectations of what God was going to do. As a matter of fact, it was completely proper culturally for God to have done those things. But God decided to make the switch. What would you do? How would you respond? What do you do when God does exactly the opposite of what you had come to expect God to do? What if all your life God had related to you in one way, and then all of a sudden God makes an entire switch? What about if God had been taking you from mountaintop to mountaintop to mountaintop, and then all of a sudden God decides to take you to valley to valley to valley? You see, God sometimes does the most unexpected, the most surprising thing that you can imagine, and all he says is, I know. I know. That wasn't what you were expecting. That wasn't what the culture presumed I would do. I know. I know. I know it's out of what you think is my character. I know. I know. But nevertheless, this is the way it's going to be. That's the first big, huge disappointment that we see. But man, we're not even into chapter 49 yet. Put your feet into the stirrups. Hold on to the rein really tight, because we are in for a group of changes which no one reading the book of Genesis until they got to this chapter could possibly have anticipated. Remember, Joseph has been built up to this point to be this great, shining, almighty knight in white armor who can conquer and demolish any dragon you set before him. And the entire expectation of these last few chapters is that God is going to do this with Joseph and beyond whatever we could imagine with Joseph, that now Joseph is going to be the main member of his father's family. Well, get ready for another set of surprises. We're in Genesis chapter 49. Then Jacob, the father of the family, called for his sons and said, gather around so I can tell you what will happen to you in days to come. Jacob, you understand, the patriarch is now functioning as a prophet. The Lord has given to him revelation about the destinies of the members of his family, about the destinies of what will become the 12 tribes of Israel. And the Lord is revealing to Jacob, who is now passing this revelation on down to the members of his family, Jacob is now functioning as a prophet. And what we are seeing in chapter 49 are divinely given, inspired prophecies. Assemble and listen, sons of Jacob. Listen to your father Israel. Reuben, you are my firstborn. And as soon as you hear that, you begin to expect that the best and the greatest things are going to be said about Reuben, that wonderful blessings are going to be given to Reuben. This is what the culture expects. This is what the culture demands. This is what every other son in the family is expecting to happen. But remember what just happened in chapter 48. God switched the blessings. Sometimes God does the completely unexpected, and that which would surprise us, as a matter of fact, that which might disappoint us the most. Assemble and listen, sons of Jacob. Listen to your father Israel. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, the first sign of my strength. You see, it's getting ready now. What wonderful thing is he going to say about his firstborn? What wonderful thing is he going to say about the one that he calls his might, his first sign of his strength, excelling in honor, excelling in power? Oh dear, turbulent as the waters, you will no longer excel. For you went up onto your father's bed, onto my couch, and defiled it. You will no longer excel. Verse 4. Notice that because of the firstborn's sin, although this had been the way in which the firstborn had experienced the privilege of being firstborn, although he had excelled in honor, although at one time he had excelled in power, now he will excel no longer. Here is the prophet telling us what we have heard so many other times in the book of Genesis and what we hear from the prophets so many other times. The Lord God is the one who lifts up kings and the one who brings them down. And you don't know from second to second what's going to happen. You may have decided that this one that you've seen go from mountaintop to mountaintop, from victory to victory, is going to be the one that God is going to place in almighty places. You may have thought that about yourself. God has taken you from position to position, from mountaintop to mountaintop, from glory to glory. You have excelled and you have excelled. And then all of a sudden, God decides to bring the consequences of your sin upon you in the blink of an eye. You may have thought you got away with it. You may have begun to entertain yourself with the idea that your sin will not catch up with you. You may have decided that God has simply pushed that under the rug, or that nobody ever saw you do it. You may have decided that you got away with it, that you covered your path so carefully, that you were able to disguise yourself so well, that you were such a great manipulator, you were able to move around all the obstacles like a dancer on a dance floor. And then all of a sudden, the Lord remembers and decides to do something about it. Bam! And the one who was once excelling is all of a sudden cast down to the depths of the sea. God is a God who is full of surprises. And one of the most stunning sayings of the Apostle Paul is this: the sins of some men go before them, and the sins of other men follow after them. In other words, the sins of some people will catch them immediately, and they will be found in their sins immediately. The sins of some go before them, but the sins of others follow up behind and bite them in the back when they're least expecting it. And this was the case with the firstborn of Jacob. you will no longer excel. When it suits God's purposes, He will bring defeat for His own reasons. Perhaps they're the reason of judgment. Perhaps they're the reason that He wants to continue His purposes through someone else. But one day, if He decides, a surprise will come into our lives. It will hit us like a bucket of ice water. And then the question will be, what will you do? What kind of person will you be when the bucket of ice water hits you, when God switches your experiences in this life? What kind of person will you be? Notice it continues here, this chapter, the story of surprises. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are weapons of violence. Let me not enter their council. Let me not join their assembly, for they have killed men in their anger and hamstrung oxen as they pleased. Cursed be their anger, so fierce, and their fury so cruel. I will scatter them in Jacob and disperse them in Israel. So the three eldest. The first one, Reuben, because of his immorality, will excel no longer. And then the next two, Simeon and Levi, because of their violence, because of their anger, because of their fury, they will be scattered and they will be dispersed. You see, here's the expectation. All right, if the firstborn wasn't given the blessing, certainly the secondborn will be. And if the secondborn isn't given the blessing, surely the third one will be. But notice that for Reuben and for Simeon and for Levi, their cruelty, their anger, their violence has removed them from the position of blessing. Do you see the way that the Lord looks upon our cruelty? Not only our cruelty to human beings, but also our cruelty to animals. They hamstrung oxen and they killed men in anger. These weren't people who were fighting to defend the family clan. These weren't men who were taking the lifeblood of oxen in order to feed the family. These were men who enjoyed killing others. They enjoyed watching people suffer, and they enjoyed and they took pleasure in the pain and the agony of others. And so the Lord is not going to pass on the blessing to them. Sexual immorality, but also a cruel heart, an angry heart. These are things upon which the Lord will not bring His blessing. Several times in the prophets and in the law of Moses, we will hear this declaration come down. Do not take pleasure in the downfall of your enemies. Do not take pleasure in the downfall of your enemies. The Lord may bring your enemies to downfall, but you are not to take pleasure in it. You are not to take pleasure. You see it as an unfortunate necessity that such and such had to happen in order to protect the clan or to protect the nation. But this idea of enjoying the downfall of others is forbidden. And to enjoy to see other things suffer, this is forbidden. Notice what the Lord is encouraging us to. Sexual purity and a gentle and compassionate heart. A heart that may see that death and suffering is necessary, but not a heart that takes pleasure in the suffering or the agony of anyone. This would be to be like unto Simeon and Levi. The sins of some go before them. The sins of others follow up behind. Reuben, Simeon, and Levi were allowed to continue down their way for a while, but here, where the blessings are given out by Jacob, the axe is finally falling. Let these three surprises also be an encouragement to you. Those of you who have been victims of injustice, those of you who have been victims of violence, those of you who think that the Lord has allowed the angry and the cruel, the immoral and the violent to escape and to never have had their repercussions, what they deserved, brought upon them. Those of you who have been victims of seeing the suffering of the innocent and of watching the pain and the death of those who deserved it not, and you think that God has turned his back and has closed his eyes and has closed his ears and has let them get away without justice, let these three surprises be encouragement to you. The Lord may not bring his justice upon the unjust in the timing in which you may wish it. You may wish for him to have brought it down immediately. You may have wished for that person to be caught and to be brought to justice quickly. You may think that God is not concerned with the terrible and the repetitive lack of justice and righteousness in our world. But when God is ready for the hammer of justice to fall, the hammer of justice will fall. And it will fall in a surprising and unexpected way, which will take the breath out of those that are watching. If someone has gone from victory to victory, from joy to joy, from advancement to advancement, those people had better be watching. For in the sound of a trumpet and in the lightning of a lightning bolt, there success will fall below them, and they will be taken to the bottom in the blink of an eye. So be warned and be comforted that when the Lord is ready for the axe to fall, it will indeed fall. As he goes to then Judah, number four. Nothing remarkable about him. Nothing stunning has been revealed about him earlier in the book of Genesis. We're not expecting much from Judah at all. No reason for us to expect what the father now says to number four. Judah, your brothers will praise you. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies, and your father's sons will bow down to you. You are a lion's cub, O Judah. You return from the prey, my son. Like a lion, he crouches and lies down. Like a lioness, who dares to rouse him? In other words, Judah is like a young lion. A young lion who is growing, a young cub who is maturing, and he is maturing into this lion that cannot be stood against, who others will see as threatening, who will be mighty and who will be strong and who will be victorious. The scepter, right, the emblem of the ruler, the emblem of the king, the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs, and the obedience of the nations is his. He He will tether his donkey to a vine, his colt to the choicest branch. He will wash his garments in wine, his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes will be darker than wine, his teeth whiter than milk. All this language here about the wine and the grapes and the milk is language which is meant to impart to us this notion that he will be so well off, his fields will be so full, his flocks and his herds so numerous that he will have enough wine that he can use it for his laundry detergent. He will have enough milk that it will turn his teeth white from it. This is the language of bounty. This is how bountiful in possessions and in blessing Judah is going to be. And did you catch the language? He will also be a king. He will also be a ruler. Back in Genesis 15, we heard that Yahweh, the God of Israel, gave to Abraham this promise that kings would come from him. The promise was given to Abraham that kings would come forth from him. And here we see that the descendant of Abraham, from whom the kings are going to come, and from whom one particular king will come through the line of Judah. Not the line of Simeon, not the line of the other two, Levi and of Reuben, but number four, the king is going to come from Judah. Did you catch that verse in verse 10? The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs. In other words, there is coming a king from the line of Judah. Notice, it's not from the line of Joseph. Oh man, what a huge letdown. The entire several last chapters have been just pumping more air and pumping more air and pumping more air and just pumping Joseph up and up and up and up to the point that he looks like Big Tex at the Texas State Fair. And everybody expects now that this big text of Israel is going to be the one who will move forward and through whom God will fulfill all the other promises. But no, the Messiah will come through the line of Judah. The King of Israel, for whom all of Israel will be waiting, for whom all of Israel will be in anticipation, will come through the line of Judah. Man, what a turn in the story. We couldn't see this coming. That was totally unexpected. Man, what a switch. But God has been pulling switches ever since chapter 48. It is the younger son of Joseph that receives the best blessing, not the firstborn. And it's not the firstborn or the secondborn or the thirdborn of Judah who received the blessing, but it's Judah number four. Man, don't ever, ever think that you've got God figured out. We're just not that smart. Don't ever think that because God has worked in your life in a pattern that goes like this, and you think you've got God in a box to where if you do this dance step, that God is going to do such and such. Where if you do the cha-cha, God is going to do this. Or if you do the tango, God is going to do that. Or if you decide to do modern dance, that God responds this way. Don't ever think that you've got God figured out. That if you stir this potion over here, if you have your quiet time 15 minutes later, or if you extend your prayer time over here and throw in a few eagle wings and dried lizard tongues of increasing your prayer time, that God will do this, or if you do that, God will respond in this way. Don't you ever, ever think that you've got God figured out. You ever seen the three shell game played on the streets of New York? Whether you've been there by yourself or whether you've watched it on TV, You ever watch this guy just switch the shells around and he asks you, which shell is the pea under? And you think you know. But you know what? You never know. God will pull a switch. The hand will go where you don't expect it, and the other hand will go where you don't expect it, and you will cry out and you will say, but God! And he will simply say this, I know. I know. You thought this. I know. I know. The culture called for that. I know. I know. You had been reading the whole story and you expected this to happen. I know. I know. But nevertheless, the blessing will go to him and not to him. Because no man knows the thoughts of God, and his ways are past finding out. The rest of the story of 49 is much like what we've already seen. We find that Zebulun is given a blessing. He will live by the seashore and he will become a haven for ships. Issachar is characterized as a raw-boned donkey. I don't think that's necessarily a compliment. But I want you to know that he will see how pleasant is his land, and he will be a man who works hard and who labors strongly. Dan will provide justice for his people. He'll be a serpent by the roadside, a viper along the paths. He'll be a man who you may not expect him to be strong, but he'll come out and bite you and surprise you with his strength. I look for your deliverance, O Lord. Gad will be attacked by a band of raiders, but he will attack them at their heels. It looks like he's going down for the count, but he's going to turn around and all of a sudden he's going to surprise you too. He's not going to be as strong as you expect him to be either. Asher's food will be good, meaning his fields will be fertile and his herds will be strong. Naphtali is a doe set free that bears beautiful fawns. Naphtali will give birth to people who are pleasing unto the Lord. And so notice Joseph, in verse 22, oh, he is a fruitful vine near a spring whose branches climb over a wall. With bitterness, archers attacked him. They shot at him with hostility, but his bow remained steady. His strong arms stayed limber because of the hand of the mighty one of Jacob. And it goes forward and just compliments Joseph after compliment. Notice with blessings of the heavens above, blessings of the deep that lie below, blessings of the breast and womb. Your father's blessings are greater than the blessings of the ancient mountains. It just goes down, just saying wondrous things about Joseph, just saying great things, not a bad thing in the world to be said about Joseph. Man, he is just a wonderful person who will have blessings upon blessings poured out on him. But the king's not going to come through him. The Messiah will not come through him. It's going to come through little old Judah. And then Benjamin. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he devours the prey. In the evening he divides his plunder. Man, Benjamin's going to be out there and he's going to be taking care of business. All these are the 12 tribes of Israel, verse 28. And this is what their father said to them when he blessed them, giving each the blessing appropriate to him. So what kind of person will you be when God brings the switch into your life? When you think you've got him all figured out, when you think you've been walking with him so long that you know exactly what's going to come next, what kind of person will you be when the switch comes? Will you be content? Will you receive from God's hand whatever he gives you with contentment? Or will you become rebellious and angry, moaning and groaning, disobedient and discontent? Would you turn with me to Philippians chapter 4? Verse 11, Philippians chapter 4 and verse 11. I am not saying this because I am in need, for I have learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want, I can do everything through Him who gives me strength. Do you see the context in which verse 13 of chapter 4 comes? It's a verse which many of us have known since we came to Christ and which many of us have memorized, and we think that it applies to any and every situation. But Paul uses it in a very particular circumstance, that Paul can be content in every situation through the one who gives him the strength to be content. What will you be when God pulls the switch? Will you cry out to the Lord for His sufficiency, not to remove the situation from you and for that to be the lust of your life, but rather will you cry out to Him who has done the switch? Will you cry out to Him for His strength to be content in the situation in which He has placed you? When He gives to someone else the blessing which the culture and the family demanded that He give to you? When the path up ends and the slide down begins? When the joy disappears and the agony is overwhelming, will you cry out to Him, not out of lustfulness to be removed from the circumstance or to have the circumstance switched again, but to be content by the means of His strength? Would you look with me at 1 Timothy chapter 6? First Timothy 6 and verse 6. But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. Godliness with contentment is great gain. Will you make those two character qualities the loves of your life? To be godly, to be pure, to be virtuous, but also to be content with whatever it is that the Lord brings into your life, and especially in those moments in which He pulls that unexpected, unanticipated, desperately unwelcome switch. So, Father, we cry out to You as Your children who struggle with contentment. We apologize to You for thinking that we know Your every step and we know Your every deed. We pray that by the Spirit who indwells us, that You will help us to be content with whatever circumstance You place us in, with whatever hand of cards You deal us. Would You strengthen us by the Spirit to be content? For we have nothing that You haven't given us. We brought nothing into the world, and we will take nothing with us out of it. And so would You make us virtuous people? Would You make us godly men and women with contentment? You are great and You are mighty, and Your ways are beyond our finding out. and your thoughts are without understanding to us. So give us godliness and give us contentment. I ask it in the name of Christ and by the Spirit.